May it please the court. Statutes are presumed to be constitutional. To prevail with a claim that a statute is unconstitutional, the petitioner, the plaintiff in this case, bears a heavy burden and must show all three of the following things. First, that the statute substantially impairs a contractual relationship. Second, that the statute lacks a significant or legitimate public purpose. And third, that the statute is based upon an unreasonable condition unrelated to an appropriate governmental objective. As the questioning focused on the constitutional necessity of having an attorney, I'm going to focus on that requirement of the statute. Is it a substantial impairment that the statute of fraud requires that parties to a palimony agreement consult with an attorney? And my answer is no. It is not required that they retain or use an attorney to draft those agreements, but the statute says that they must receive independent legal advice from their own counsel before entering into these palimony agreements. I do not see that as a substantial impairment. That is a reasonable imposition on a party who wants to enter into a contract.
What if the party can't afford an attorney? Is that...
So again, Judge, this is not requiring that parties have to pay the attorney to draft the agreement. They have to consult with their own independent counsel.
But don't they have to... There aren't many attorneys that are offering free services to just be consulted.
There are certainly free consultations available to parties. But even if we take that out of the equation, is it a substantial impairment to a party's ability to enter into a contract to require that they hire an attorney for 1 or 2 hours of their time to be educated on what the law will or will not require in a non-marital relationship? And my answer to that is no. I don't believe that is a substantial impairment to any party's ability to enter into a contract.
What's the rational, forget about the contracts, but what is the rational basis for this statute requiring compelling attorneys when no other statute?
Your Honor, there is one other statute, the lottery statute.
So I'm familiar with the lottery statute. We're not talking about the constitutionality there, but there's a pot of money in the lottery statute, and the legislature can condition, since it's controlling that there be some sort of review so that money that they're now giving to someone is spent properly. Put that aside. What are you familiar with any other statute, either in this state or any other state, that compels the parties to a contract to have attorneys?
Again, Judge, this statute isn't compelling the parties to have an attorney. They must seek independent counsel from an attorney.
Well, what happens if they don't get an attorney?
Well, what happens is the contract is not enforced.
So then it's compelling them to get attorneys.
Well, to consult with an attorney. They do not need to hire or retain like the lottery statute requires. It must retain and consult. This just says consult with an attorney. And Your Honor brought up the comparison to criminal statutes and the ability for defendants to waive their right to counsel. That happens after a defendant has been advised, A, of what they're charged with, B, what the consequences are, and C, they then waive that right to counsel if they're facing consequences of a magnitude. So there's a step in that process where
the rationale for that case, and it goes to civil cases too, is the right of self-determination. People have a right to control and conduct their lives, even to make poor choices for themselves. That's the basis for Feretta and our whole line of jurisprudence. And if that would apply in a courtroom, how could it not apply to the simple making of a contract, the right of self-autonomy?
The simple making of a contract, I think, undervalues the dilemma of these palimony cases up until the statute of frauds in 2010. In Kozlowski, the state recognized in 1979, when they created this common law claim, that these are not business transactions. These are details of an interpersonal relationship that are complicated, that are difficult to prove, that are subject to pressures and influences that other business contracts simply aren't subject to. We have an entire division of our courts, the family division, that acknowledges that conflict between families or family-like relationships are different. We have Rule 5, which governs family court and what has to happen. We already treat these types of relationships other than regular business contracts. We have an alimony statute that tells parties when they get married what will be required of you, what your obligations are, what you're entitled to. We have a statute that talks about child support. So parties that get married are put on notice by the laws, by the statutes, as to what that choice of getting married means and what you're either going to be entitled to or obligated to do. In palimony, we have parties who have made the choice to not get married, and they've made that choice for any number of reasons. In this case, the plaintiff had been married previously. When she met the defendant, she was going through a divorce that took her 8 years. She was receiving alimony until 2011. So although this was an 18-year relationship, we have a plaintiff who until 2011 is receiving alimony from her first husband. So then we have 2011 until 2014 when the agreement is written, and then the relationship ends in 2015. So we really only have a 4-year window here, unless what we're prepared to do is say, you can be collecting alimony from husband number one while also accumulating a claim for money and payment from relationship number two, so long as you don't get married. Because if they had gotten married, her alimony would have terminated. So all of these intricacies in interpersonal relationships and family relationships are different. They aren't just, I pay you $100 and you give me 100 widgets.
There's a contract. It's in writing. It was notarized.
But again,
it would, in any other circumstance, it would be enforceable, except under this statute, unless both sides are represented by an attorney, it's no good.
That's correct. The statute of frauds, as it stands and as it's drafted, says that each party has to have independent advice of counsel for palimony to then be enforceable. It doesn't say you can't enter into these agreements. It says we are requiring you to take this extra step. And in this case, based on the facts that I just laid out, it's to protect the defendant in this case as much as the plaintiff. The discussion about parties with uneven bargaining power really doesn't apply to this case. We have a plaintiff in this case who worked throughout the relationship. She did not give up anything to continue in this relationship. She was a stewardess or flight attendant. She had the ability to make her own savings for retirement. She had available to her benefits. This is not someone who gave up her career in architecture like some of the earlier cases. This is not someone who, to their detriment, stayed in this relationship. If anything, she benefited from the financial support that she got during the relationship while still working and having an ability to maintain her financial independence, plus receiving alimony. So in this case, we don't have someone who is disadvantaged but by any of the requirement that she simply talked.
Didn't she give the alimony up as a result of this agreement?
In 2011, she was served with a motion to enforce based on her cohabitation. She entered into a consent order in 2011. This agreement was not until 2014. It was 3 years later. And so basic contract principles, if we're going to return to that, we cannot enforce a contract in 2014 based on consideration, if you will, giving up the alimony 3 years earlier.
If you're right on the constitutional argument, is there no role for equity in these sorts of situations?
Judge, I would submit that there is not, and that was an intentional change in the law. Once you got to Maker and you had the amendment to the statute of frauds, the case law is clear. This court was clear that this is a sea change in the law because of the very fact-specific interpersonal factors that go into these palimony relationships.
So suppose you have, in a situation not that far from this one, a clear promise, and one of the individuals admitting that he was being dishonest. He had absolutely no intention of following through with it. No role for equity?
No, Judge, I don't see that there is, because then that returns us to the pre-statute of frauds standing, where each plaintiff can come to this court, any court, and say, our relationship was different. Because of the facts and the way this played out, I couldn't talk to an attorney. I couldn't do this or do that because our relationship was different. And they may not be wrong.
What if all the elements of common law fraud are met? No role?
Judge, I don't see there being a role, no.
And suppose one of the parties is an attorney who is well-versed in the statute of frauds, and the other party is unaware of it. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. But you've compounded the dishonesty in the way ordinary people would look at this situation. Still no role for equity?
But in that case, Your Honor, you are again illustrating why it's important for that party to seek the advice of counsel prior to.
I'm focused on whether there's a role for equity. I'm not asking you to explain the rationale for the statute. Mm-hmm. I'm asking if, under the circumstances, given the statute's existence and stepping aside from the constitutional question, is there a role for equity in the family court?
There's always a role for equity in the family
court. But not in this situation.
Because in palimony agreements, every case every plaintiff would be justified in saying, but my case is different. And part of what the court was struggling with was, A, the impossibility of proving what the relationship is, what the promise was, what the arrangements were, but also the difficulty of assessing what's the consideration. It gets very complicated.
It may be hard to assess these cases. You may be quite right about that. But your argument, as I understand it, is that courts may not even hear the argument, may not wade into this area, because equity has no role in light of the statute. Have I overstated your argument? That's how I'm hearing it.
Hearing it reflected back to me, Your Honor, I would certainly not want to make a broad statement like that. I think in this case, there is no need for equity based on everything that I indicated about the facts in this case. Plus, a very important fact in this case is that the plaintiff was added to the deed of the house. And as counsel indicated, if the intention was always that she would have the house, she's on the deed. She's added to the deed once her alimony terminates.
I'm struggling with this case, and we're not going to litigate this case here, but didn't your client admit in his testimony that he was being dishonest as he crafted this document that he took and signed in front of a notary?
So his testimony was that he put this piece of paper in front of her, quote, to shut her up. Again, illustrating the frailty of the human relationship and why we can't treat this like a regular business contract.
And he also say that he had no intention of following through on that agreement?
He said that after the fact, yes.
And in circumstances such as that, your position is equity has no role.
I'm not saying that equity has no role, but in this case, what is the injustice? What is the detriment to the plaintiff? What did she give up in 2014? What's the remedy?
Well, if you strip away the attorneys, it's an enforceable contract. Do you agree?
Assuming the statute of frauds were not in place?
Assuming that you don't need attorneys. Okay, to be consulted with. It's an enforceable contract. Would you agree?
Yes, it would be, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, even if two attorneys had entered into this palimony agreement, under the statute, they would have to get independent advice of counsel. They couldn't, even two attorneys couldn't enter into a palimony agreement without the assistance of some other attorney, correct?
Without consulting with an independent counsel, that's correct, Your Honor. And again, as an attorney who handles family law, I'm certainly not someone to consult about a business agreement or an incorporation agreement. I think it comes down to, when you're looking at the constitutional questions, we talk about, is it a substantial impairment? And I submit that it's not. The second question is...
You just raised a question I hadn't thought of. The attorney to be consulted with need have no experience whatever in this area of law, and the statute is still satisfied. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you could go to a criminal defense attorney who's never handled any matter of this nature, and that would be satisfactory?
That would satisfy the statute. And again,
what's the rational thinking behind that?
So again, we can debate whether this statute is the appropriate way to address palimony moving forward, but as the court has already acknowledged, that policy discussion is not for this venue. Does it make sense for the legislature to enact a palimony statute, much like there is an alimony statute or a child support statute? I would submit, yes, it does, for a lot of reasons, because just as society changed in the 50s and 60s, necessitating this common law claim to be developed through the courts, society has likewise changed now. When I read these cases, talking about the plaintiff, and the plaintiff is always a woman, it feels disingenuous to not have that conversation when we're talking about this. Talking about the plaintiff, the recipient of the money, acting like a wife, doing the cleaning and the cooking, and accompanying the man on his business entertainment, there's a bigger change that needs to be fleshed out as far as what is the role of palimony. We now have an alimony statute as of 2014 where we don't have permanent alimony anymore, but palimony potentially rises to a claim of support for life. We don't even have that when you're married. Did we truly intend to give unmarried individuals a greater claim to financial relief than those who get married?
You're using these other examples. I'm trying to figure out the relationship to this case. Because in none of alimony, custody, every other phase of family law does not require attorneys, okay? People can do that on their own. There could be one attorney and a self-represented party. Every one of those, except this one.
But, Your Honor,
what is a rational basis for this? Why is this contract different from every other contract, okay, in the universe of statutes?
Your Honor, in all of those cases, at some point, a conflict will come before the court, or there will be an event in the court where there's a ratification of that agreement, where the parties are notified, as I mentioned in one of the briefs. When we have an uncontested divorce hearing, the court goes through a plea colloquy. Or if we submit it on the papers, there's a certification where the parties say, I've been advised that I could consult with an attorney before entering into this agreement. That can't happen in palimony. There is no divorce. There is no event. There is no pause. There is no other juncture but for when this promise is made for the parties to be informed as to what is or isn't going to be required of them. Because there's also no statute that governs how much palimony are you entitled to. Unlike alimony, where we have 14 factors, palimony, as judicially created, became a claim where you got a lump sum payout based on what your life expectancy is moving forward.
You use the term palimony, and I understand it's because of the historical context. But this is just a contract. Okay, this isn't some oral representation to support someone for life. It's a simple contract dividing property. Why do we have to put this label palimony on it? Why isn't it like any other contract?
But, Your Honor, if you look at the contract, what is the consideration then? If we're going to treat it just as any type of contract, if you look at the terms of this, it says when the relationship ends or if it ends, the defendant will do five things. He will pay out the mortgage. He will transfer the deed. He will pay the taxes for 5 years. What is the consideration then by the plaintiff if we're not going to consider her relationship or staying in the relationship the consideration? So it's not just a contract, because the only consideration that there is the plaintiff staying in the relationship, which is palimony. And it needs to be treated differently, because again, it's when my adversaries talked about other parties could do this, again, we have to go back to the basics of contract law. What is the offer, the acceptance, and the consideration? In this agreement, we don't have any consideration if we're not considering her relationship. And we've already said that a contract where staying in the relationship is the consideration, that is palimony by definition. And the appellate division hit that on the head. While the trial court may have not liked the defendant in this case and tried to fashion a remedy, the reality is this was a palimony agreement. This was, what am I going to pay at the end of the relationship if or when the relationship terminates? That is the definition of palimony. And therefore, it needs to comply with the requirements in the statute of frauds as of today. Again, as to whether there needs to be legislative action that more clearly addresses this to reflect society today, to reflect what is necessary today, to give individuals notice of, okay, if you're in a relationship for 10 years, here's what you need to expect, just as we have in our alimony statute. When you get married, it changes. We make a decision to get married, and it entitles you or obligates you to do certain things. We don't have that for palimony. And again, that's a discussion for another day with the legislature.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to your presentation?
Again, Your Honors, I would just like to refocus on, if we're going to render a statute unconstitutional, it's a high burden. And the plaintiff must show that there's a substantial impairment, which I submit there is not. This plaintiff had an attorney as recently as 2011 and had been through an 8-year divorce. And again, we're not saying that you have to retain or use an attorney to draft the agreement. You must seek independent advice of counsel. That is not a substantial impairment to one's right to enter into a contract. The statute must lack any significant or legitimate public purpose. The court said the clarity in contracts between individuals at the end of a relationship to create certainty and financial security, it serves a public purpose. So there's certainly a legitimate public purpose to be served by the statute of frauds. And last, the statute would need to impose an unreasonable condition. And again, I submit that there's nothing unreasonable about requiring it to be in writing, signed by both parties after independent advice of counsel. I'd ask you to affirm the appellate court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts, and thank you to counsel. We will take the matter under advisement.